I would like to welcome you all to this afternoon's talk. Is this okay? Is this audible?
Yeah,
okay.
That's better.
Okay, good. Okay.
Could you just move that bottle away?
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Is this better?
Yeah.
Okay, please let me know because it's hard to know about myself, you know. Before starting, I would like to acknowledge Marieke Conscious, who is here today, and she translated some Dutch text for me. This is a very international art talk, so I needed to read a lot of things like in Italian, German, and I couldn't read Dutch, so she was the one. And I would like to also acknowledge Terra and Ford Foundations, who supported my research in Europe and in Washington, D.C. So is it okay? So I would like to start now. In January 1963, can everyone hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. The Dutch Nullo artist Henk Peters wrote a letter to Eddy de Velde, the director of the Van Ave Museum in Eindhoven, the Netherlands, regarding the second Nullo exhibition. Peters proposed an execution of Yves Klein's Fire and Water Fountains along with the German Zero artist Otto Pienaar's light projection. Since the letter didn't contain any illustrations, I just picked up this one. I think this was done 2 years later, but what he was thinking was something equivalent to this in a very, very grand scale. De Velde began considering bringing Nul to Eindhoven after seeing a critically acclaimed first Nullo exhibition that took place at the Stedelijk Museum in Amsterdam in 1962. This is that exhibition. The 1962 exhibition included 25 loosely associated like-minded artists born in Argentina, Belgium, Brazil, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, and the Netherlands. Aside from the core members of Nul, such as Armando, Jan Hendricks, Henk Peters, and Jan Schoenhoven, some Italian and German participants had their own groups, which were the German Zero Group with Heinz Mack, Otto Pine, and Günther Jucker, and Italian Azimuth artist with Enrico Castellani and Piero Manzoni. The middle person is Heinz Mack, who belongs to Zero Group, but they are sort of like interchangeable groups. Okay. Other participants, such as Japanese Yayoi Kusama and the Belgian Bernard Obeltan, were independent. Additionally, the 1965 Nullo exhibition invited Gutai Art Association from Japan. Such cultural diversity was explained by Peters that, quote, "I didn't make a revolution, I couldn't make a revolution by myself," unquote. So he invited others from around the world to help realize a new global culture, as opposed to the national art that governed the dark days of World War II. The chief members of Azimuth Nul and Zero functioned also as producers, created their own exhibitions, and published their art magazines that enabled them to circulate information about their work beyond national boundaries. The group's unspoken agreement was that if the Dutch were included in the show in Germany, the Germans should be included in the exhibition in the Netherlands. In concert, they promoted their art internationally and attempted to gain attention in the highly competitive European art world in the period immediately following the war. Despite geographic distances, Azimuth, Nul, and Zero artists came out of similar circumstances sources. Most of them were born between 1925 and 1935, grew up during the Great Depression, witnessed the rise of fascism, and embarked on their careers immediately after the war. Such cultural, economic, and geopolitical globalization seemed to have led to a shared worldview, hence the stylistic affinity. Observing the works shown at the new exhibition, the former MoMA curator Laura Hauptmann wrote that their monomorphism, monomorphism, which means serial repetition of a single motif, which you see it on our screen now, right now, and monochronism, which means one color. And white is actually not really monochrome, because chrome means color and white is achrome, which means means non-color, but these are kind of works they were doing. Well, ideal formal strategies to reinforce the concrete nature of art, an artwork as an artwork and nothing else. These European geometric tendencies took place slightly earlier than US minimalism. Among the European groups, Zero attracted considerable interest since early on both sides of the Atlantic. Established in 1958, already in 1963, the group was holding a major retrospectives in a German museum and the art spaces in the United States and England. Okay, this is the cover of the Zero Group exhibition catalog in Philadelphia. The cover was done by the US artist Robert Indiana, and there was really interchangeable groups, so they were sort of like expansionist in a way that they were going beyond the borders in various aspects. Okay. However, their popularity declined after 1965. Only in the 1990s did the art world take a renewed interest in their art. In today's talk, I will explore first how did similar geometric tendencies simultaneously come to take place in different parts of the world. Secondly, what were the significances of European geometric abstraction represented by Azimuth, Null, and Zero? And finally, why the international art world had such a short-lived interest in these groups in relation to the impact of the Cold War? The first study made on the relationship between culture and the Cold War was by Sieg Guillebeau in his controversial book from 1983 entitled How New York Stole the Idea of Modern Art, Abstract Expressionism, Freedom, and the Cold War. Guillebeau argued how intertwining relationship among art, politics, and ideology, and especially MoMA's role in promoting avant-garde art by collaborating with the United States Information Service as early as 1947, turned the left-wing avant-garde art, notably abstract expressionism, into a political art for art's sake. And just to mention that this is the exhibition scene from MoMA's The Road to Victory show, which was held during World War II. But everyone was very much nationalistic during the war, so it's unavoidable to have some exhibition like this one. Guillebeau believed that such art could serve as the place for the US government to inscribe and promote their ideology. Ever since, whether culture was used as a weapon of the Cold War has been a topic of discussion. The latest study on the Cold War cultural politics is from 2007 by the Japanese scholar Takeshi Matsuda and his book Soft Power and Its Perils. In the book, Matsuda argued that the U.S. insertion of culture in war-torn countries changed the U.S. perception in abroad that resulted in occupied territories' voluntary acceptance of the United States as a new global leader. From my own research at the Smithsonian Institution and the National Archives, it became clear that contrary to Gilbert's argument, the US government was not very eager to promote contemporary art. This is because selecting art involves personal taste. In 1946, when the government organized Advancing American Art Exhibition, a traveling show of United States contemporary art to Europe and Latin American countries, U.S. taxpayers firstly protested the inclusion of some works, such as Circus Girl Resting, by the Japanese immigrant artist Yasuo Kuniyoshi. They said it's an un-American and inappropriate to represent the country. After this show, the government concentrated mainly on giving factual information about the United States and its people through exhibitions. However, in March 1949, U.S. Advisory Commission on Information emphasizes the importance of private agencies, groups, and individuals to disseminate information about the United States abroad. MoMA's role as an organizer of international exhibition comes in this context. Although Gilbert contended MoMA's association with CIA, the institution democratically handled the mission by putting together professional advisees. During President John F. Kennedy's Democratic administration, when the government attempted to directly funding the international exhibitions, the U.S. art truly rose to global prominence, which I will discuss later in this talk. Okay. In occupied territories, U.S. art entered into people's consciousness through the government's media control since World War II. In competition with the Nazis' information control, the U.S. government saw the distribution of information as one of the three essential components in carrying out its foreign policy. The other two were the military and the economy, and culture was an integral part. As understood from the aforementioned U.S. Commission on Information report, the government systematically propagated information about the country and their people through new technology. This is the chart from the advisory's report. IBD stands for International Broadcasting Division, and INP stands for International Press and Publication, and IMP stands for International Motion Pictures Division. With a concerted effort of controlling mass media, U.S. information penetrated into 84 countries. And these are what happening right after the war. These American programs stimulated the tremendous intellectual appetite in war-torn countries where people longed for news, commentaries, books, magazines, movies, photographs, and other cultural products. The USIS agents also established contracts with local government officials, political leaders, newspaper editors, counting a few, in order to generate pro-US opinions. The Cold War was, after all, psychological warfare. The US government's avid promotion of information led people in the occupied territories to often willingly accept all things American. Although in the 50s, while Paris was still regarded as the center of the art world, European artists often did not admit U.S. influence on their art. However, in his WNYC radio interview, the MoMA curator, Kynast McShine, observed in 1968 as, quote, "Don't forget Time magazine, for example, or Life magazine, is on the newsstand in Brazil or Rome or Singapore, all on the same Wednesday morning. At this point, modern art is a completely international thing that goes beyond the boundaries of any one country or the other," unquote. This was happening because after the war, Time, Life, Newsweek, the Paris edition of the New York Herald Tribune and the air edition of the New York Times were distributed throughout the world at the State Department's own expense, as McShine pointed out, in the period following the war. On one hand, modern art was becoming global, and on the other, the US art was becoming the global standard. Going back to European geometric artists, by contrasting the first and second issues of Azimuth magazine published in 1959 and 1960, one would recognize that the artists featured in the magazine, notably Castellani, Manzoni, Mack, and Jan Schoenhoven, all initially belonged to Art Informel, which means School of Expressionism. But by 1960, their works were suddenly transformed into rigid, orderly geometric art. Just to show you a few examples, this is Manzoni, Mack. You can see, there were chaotic expression on the left-hand side, and it becomes more orderly to your right. This is Jan Schoenhoven. In general, Art Informel is distinguished by thick layers of paint and unrestrained brush strokes, and these are the type of works done by Art Informel artists. Also, the French word informe means formlessness. The chief proponent of the movement, the French critic and curator Michel Tapier, included a global array of artists working with diverse abstract modes, among them Jackson Pollock, Mark Tobey, the Japanese Gutai group, Sam Francis, John Fortier, and George Mathieu. The diversity meant that the movement was seen as vague. Even the artists who were regarded as informal did not always agree with each other. For example, Fortier, who is to your left, who flattened paints with his fingers and slashed them with a palette knife or brush handles, spent long time on his canvas and worked mostly at his studio. He disliked Matthew's way of making a spectacle out of the process of his work. This is what Matthew did in terms of promoting his art, or this is called gestural abstraction. What then was Tapie's criterion for defining the movement? In 1952, Tapier published a book, An Art Autre, or An Art That Is Different, in which he defined Art Informel as the intense physical involvement with matter. And you can see that artists are sort of like wrestling with his material or paint on the screen. Further, the Japanese Gutai scholar Mizuho Kato carefully analyzed Tapie's difficult writing and concluded that what Tapie looked for really was, quote, other aesthetic, unquote. To understand how Tapie came to this point, Hans Namuth's famous Pollock studio photograph printed in Life magazine in 1949, in my view, is important. Suddenly, in the early 50s, artists in different parts of the world began exposing the process of their art making and attempted to break all the taboos related to paintings. Showing some of the examples, this is American painter Sam Francis demonstrating his abstraction in Japan. This is a Japanese painter, Akira Kanayama, who showed in the second Nulo exhibition, making his painting with the machine. And finally, this is another Gutai group. By the way, the Kanayama is also a part of Gutai group. This is called Wrestling in the Earth by Kazuo Shiraga, who was also a member of Gutai. This performance was made exclusively for a Life magazine photographer, but the article never got published. Although these artists, don't easily admit Pollock's influence, discounting their performative aspects, two issues of Gutai magazine were found among Pollock's possessions after his death in 1956, with the U.S. government's uncompromising information control. By the mid-50s, the U.S. art was becoming the global standard for vanguard artists. Although Azimuth, Null, and Zero artists were initially engaged in inventing other aesthetics, it was their shared experience of war that inherently shaped their work. Their European influence came from the French artist Yves Klein's Blue Monochrome exhibition in 1957 that traveled to Milan, Düsseldorf, and London. And it was also held in Paris. According to Nicolas Chalet, Piero Manzoni, who is a person belonging to Azimuth Group, visited the exhibition of Klein's daily while Klein's show was up at Milan's Galleria Apollinaire. Manzoni declared that Klein's paintings were a revelation to him. When Yves Propositions Monochromes opened at Gallery Schlemmer in Düsseldorf, Heinz Mack and Otto Pine, the members of Zero, recognized Klein as an important catalyst for their evolution as an artist. Henk Peters also thought that including Klein in the Null exhibition was crucial. What then was the significance of Klein's popularity in Europe? Klein's work, according to the Marxist art historian Benjamin Buchlow, is the neo-avant-garde. Buchlow explains that it was the Russian avant-garde Vladimir Rodchenko who, in 1921, produced the original monochromatic art. In 1939, Rodchenko retrospectively described his work and called it as, quote, end of painting. For Rodchenko and other Russian constructivist artists, only by reducing painting into the pure materiality of paints could artists under Soviet communism start determining the social function of art. Such functional art contained the danger of reducing art into pure propaganda, such as this Rodchenko's political poster from 1924. He did a lot of political works under Stalin's administration. On the other hand, Buchlow regarded the second wave of avant-garde art, such as Klein's anthropometries, as art turned into spectacle for a capitalist audience. And these are the audience of Klein's artwork. On the other hand, the artists who survived the fascist regime of Third Reich, Pine and Mack, observed that Bauhaus, which reduced art into utilitarian objects, which was something similar to what Russian constructivists were doing, and the Nazis, both used technology to advance their goals for society. And this is one of the political posters which I couldn't go through the German propaganda posters, but this is again Rodchenko's poster. Witnessing the arts turning into tools of ideology, Zero artists, according to the curator and Zero specialist Valerie Hillings, expected their spectators to just have fun in encountering their work. What did she meant by saying having fun with their artwork? Going back to Klein's monochrome painting, Klein commented that when he conceived his monochromes, he was specifically thinking of materiality of informal art that he wrote, "I detest the artists who void themselves into their paintings, as in so often the case today. How morbid. Instead of reflecting on the beautiful, the good, and the true, they render up, they ejaculate, they spit out all their horrible, rotten, and infectious complexity into their paintings, as though to relieve themselves and load down others the readers of their work with all their burden and remorse of failure, unquote. With his monochromes, Klein celebrated the ability to transcend the physical and psychological limits of the self. They were the reminders of the spiritual substances, with the color blue linking to the depth of the void, emerging from totalitarianism, where all arts were becoming political tools, also witnessing the post-war development where artists were becoming tormented geniuses. Azimuth, nude and zero artists began thinking of more positive arts. Klein's monochromes were their immediate inspiration, and he became a key figure in all three groups. In the spring of 1958, Klein presented the void, or the monochrome exacerbations, at the gallery Iris Clare. He explained the work, quote, my paintings are now invisible, unquote. Being exposed to the empty contemplative space, Klein's audience irresistibly had to focus on their inner self, like the meditation in Zen Buddhism. Klein's background as the Japanese martial arts judo practitioner had no small impact on this, since all martial arts in Japan established on Zen philosophy. However, Klein was not alone in thinking of the void. Mack and Pine, when they launched their art movement, they named their group Zero, which meant nothingness and void. They conceived Zero as the zone of silence for a new beginning. The other artists, Piero Manzoni, also regarded his linear series, which is up on the screen, not measuring, quote, meters or kilometers, but is zero. Not zero as the end, but as the beginning of an infinite series. The concept of infinity is a trademark of the Null participant Yayoi Kusama, who was born and raised in Japan and lived in New York City. Like European artists, she too grew up under an oppressive fascist regime where the government demanded every citizen to conform to their order. Kusama recounted her years of war, quote, imperialism and militarism melded together deprived individuals of their ability to develop free thinking, unquote. While growing up, she recalled that she could only formulate her distinctive self only through painting. However, the self she envisioned was not an absolute figure like the Japanese dictator Hideki Tojo, but a humble self. The new self she invented was like the return and repeat of waves. It was a modest and disciplined self out of which she made her first infinity net painting, which is called Pacific Ocean. And she says this, the depiction of waves became her infinity net painting, which is this white painting. Okay. Similar to Kusama, Klein also described himself as, my position on contemporary art is horizontal. If the modern artists before World War II, such as Picasso and Matisse, were prominent geniuses, these new artists were humble yet not nihilistic, that they were filled with new hopes living in the war-torn countries. One thing that distinctively marks the works by Azimuth, Null, and Zero artists are energy. Okay. These are the artists who are engaging in fire paintings. And this is something very well-known, Yves Klein painting with the flames. Okay. And then going back to Klein's canonical work, Anthropometries, one of the models in the anthropometry, Elena Palumbo-Mosca, spoke of her experience of performing Klein's painting, quote, "The blue impregnated body then became for me a clear symbol of life's energy," unquote. When Klein thought of creating anthropometries, his initial plan was to make the human imprints by using blood and other body fluids. The other Azimuth artist, Pierre Manzoni, also thought of making art out of his own excrements. This translates artist shit. That's the title of the artwork. These bodily excreta, according to Nicole Root, let artists transcend beyond the limits of the body, since they are the traces of human body, and the very body here becomes formless and invisible. The concept of transcendence and human energy both became important for the German zero among the geometric tendencies. Okay. In 1964, Pinek proclaimed Zero to be the new idealist. The first issue of Zero magazine, published in 1958, asked, quote, "Does contemporary painting influence the shape of the world?" Unquote. What Zero aimed at with their art was social transformation. For this, they sought to bring about a synthesis in art of the material represented by object and the spiritual manifested in energy. In order to transform society, they sought human energies and therefore brought their art to the street. The most significant event for Zero in 1961 was a demonstration that took place on the evening of July 5th in the old town of Düsseldorf in front of Galleria Schmeler. Among the participants, one can identify a young Joseph Beuys, who is with a hat in the center of this picture, later engaged in sculpting society, and he became a much better known artist in the contemporary art world than Zero Group. But without understanding Zero properly, it's so difficult to understand the post-war art in Germany. Okay. In the early 60s, Zero had considerable recognition in the United States. Valerie Hillings described Zero's arrival for the New York exhibition at Howard Weiss Gallery in 1964 as, quote, "The press met Yucker and Mack at the airport. A photo taken on that occasion evokes images of the Beatles' arrival in New York," unquote. So it was extremely popular artists in New York in 1964. But their popularity declined in the very next year as the US pop artists gained global prominence. This took place right after the moment when MoMA stepped down from sponsoring international exhibitions in 1962, and when the government took over the financial burden of international exhibitions under the aegis of the US Information Agency. Without having solid opinion about contemporary art, the officials appointed Alan Solomon, the director of Jewish Museum, as a commissioner of the 1964 Venice Biennial, and put all the responsibilities on him. Solomon was one of the clients of Leo Castelli, the Austro-Hungarian Jewish art dealer, who was deeply disillusioned by the European civilization as both of his parents perished in the war. Castelli, together with his former wife, Ileana Sonnabend, had an ambition to globally promote American art and establish their businesses. And this is the art magazine promoting ad in the art magazine promoting their gallery's activities in 1964 and explaining like where you can see the Castelli artists in Europe. Having their clients as the commissioner of the Venice Biennial, in 1964 Biennial, 4 out of 8 artists represented the United States belonged to the Leo Castelli. American presence that year at Venice was especially notorious. Solomon provocatively proclaimed in the official Biennial catalog that, quote, "It is now generally recognized that the world's center of art has moved from Paris to New York," unquote. Further, he distributed handouts at the U.S. Pavilion saying, quote, Paris had lost its rank as international art center to New York, unquote. Moreover, Solomon had an aggressive exhibition strategy of presenting the U.S. artists at two different spaces, one at the official U.S. pavilion and the other at the former U.S. consulate. And this is the picture from the U.S. consulate at the biennial. Robert Rauschenberg won the gold medal for painting, the first American to do so. But when his prize was almost jeopardized for not having enough work at the official site of the biennial, the government moved his combines from the U.S. pavilion early one morning. The scene was promptly captured by Castelli and Solomon's photographer friend Hugo Mullas and offered for publicity. And this picture is very well known if you go over like archival sources in 1964. The whole event led the popular press to condemn the scenario as the American cultural colonization of Europe. But the notorious incident ultimately worked favorably for the commercial viability of American art. In the 70s, 40% of Castelli Gallery sale was his European clients. During the Cold War, as stated in the Commissioner's Report from 1949, the government was eager to globally circulate information about the United States, but depended on private efforts to promote U.S. art. Such initial intent changed for a brief period after 1962. However, the government's disinterest in cultural contents was used as an opportunity by the emerging private enterprises, neglecting the entrepreneur having ever stronger power to shape the post-war world, art world. By 1971, the Republican government fully endorsed the marketplace, emphasizing on a return to reliance on private efforts and funding with regard to international exhibitions. As the U.S. art gained commercial prominence, European new tendencies such as azimuth, null, and zero were overshadowed. In one instance, Hank Peters recollected that he sold only 9 works in his entire career. On the other hand, it has been institutional efforts that attempted to uncover some forgotten yet important artistic tendencies in the period following World War II. Thank you. Is there any questions? I hope my voice was audible.
Yes.
It's kind of like a new territory that this Zero Group, the exhibition has been only curated since like 1990s. So, and it involves a lot of like different languages, and it's kind of like difficult.
How would you summarize the fundamental principles of the Zero Movement?
Oh, their movement. It's very geometric and also repetition of the singular form, but their work also can be characterized with like the light and movement and also like energy emitted through light. So it's something which is, it's seen on the screen, but there's something very intangible about it. Like when you look at the actual Zero exhibition, it's all about shadows and lights in the dark room. So it's the principle is geometric, but it's something very organic as well. And that is very interesting. Is there any other comments? Yes.
When I look at the Yves Klein here, I'm told that Rothko's paintings originally had a luminosity, an interior glow,
right,
because of the materials he used that faded over time, because I've never seen it in any of his paintings.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, is there any relationship between Klein, because this is being done in the 50s.
Right.
Because it seems to have the luminosity that, mm-hmm, I'm told Rothko had.
I think that's a very interesting observation. What Klein did was, I agree that Rothko has internal glow, and Klein's case, I think he wanted to show the depth in his painting. So he invented this special glue, which when you bind the pigments and with this glue, the pigments doesn't become very flat or like shiny. It's more like the pigment itself, you know. When you look at Klein's piece, which is now installed on the fourth floor of MoMA, it looks very dry, actually, and with the ambiguous depth. And I think what he wanted to show with his painting is really about infinity. So in such sense, I think there is some connection with Rothko, but in a very different through a very different approach.
But you agree that Rothko's paintings originally have this kind of luminosity, and it just because of
yes, it has actually, and yes, and he knows so much about oil painting and nature of oil paint, so he knows how to make it very matte or very shiny, and he controls it in terms of like trying to show his internal glow. So toward the end of Rothko's career, his painting becomes very dark and at the same time very luminous.
Then he didn't know enough about his materials to guarantee his perpetuity, apparently.
Well,
you know, that is not the case anymore.
Yeah. I think he always knew about the paints, but toward the end of his life, I think the painting had changed, and that's when he started making, like, you know, employing, like, the shiny materials. That's my interpretation. Thank you. Yes.
What about the influence of Japanese calligraphic artists?
Well, yes, there were.
You didn't mention.
Well, the talk was only 40 minutes, so I couldn't incorporate it. But there were a lot of like interest in Japanese art, and I was hoping that maybe I could suggest it through bringing out Eve Klein's, like, you know, the martial art practice and martial art and calligraphies. Like, this is what anthropologists has been like detecting, that there is the same sort of like Zen influence, and in Klein's case, it comes from that, but certainly there were a lot of like Japanese interest in Asian art and philosophies in the 50s, which was extremely interesting.
And did you say the influence came from Jackson Pollock?
Oh, well, I think the one hand it came from Jackson Pollock, but the other hand in Europe, I think European civilization sort of like, you know, there was such a disillusionment in European civilization because of like Holocaust and other things, that people were looking for something alternative, and that's where like Eastern philosophy came in. And in Europe especially, there were a lot of interest in Asian philosophies, and Tachism or Art Informel on one hand was very much like Asian influenced, and that's why like a person like Michel Tapier, he's the main proponent of the movement, went to Japan, and he found some other Japanese like counterpart of Informel there. So there was an interest and also, I believe, in influence. But in terms of zero, they weren't really looking, or as if they weren't really looking into Asia. Asia for them came through Eve Klein. And Eve Klein's Japanese influence has been very much overlooked. But he lived 13 months with a Japanese art critic while he was living in Japan, and this critic was really like a central exponent of Japanese vanguard art during that time. So I think, and then after he came back to France, that's when he really started becoming an artist. So I think the Japanese influence was very, very strong on him, and there is a lot of room to write about that. Thank you. Is there any other? Okay, thank you very much.